Welcome to the Georgia FinTech Academy podcast. The Georgia FinTech Academy is a collaboration between Georgia's fintech industry and the University System of Georgia. This talent development initiative addresses a massive demand for fintech professionals and gives learners the specialized education experiences needed to enter the fintech sector.
Hi, everybody. This is Tommy Marshall, the Executive Director of the Georgia FinTech Academy. Welcome to episode 7 of our Georgia FinTech Academy podcast. Today is April the 16th, and I have two guests with me today that I'll introduce here in a second. But first, just for historical purposes, we've been keeping track of the COVID-19 public health crisis metrics. As of today, worldwide, there's 2 million cases of COVID-19. And in the U.S., we're now at 644,000. And in the state of Georgia, where the three of us are today, there's a little over 14,000 cases. Recent news on the virus is that things seem to be peaking in the New York market. And then there was a big, really scary outbreak in South Dakota in a meatpacking factory that was very concentrated, and those two items have been getting a lot of press. And then there's been beginnings of a lot of talk about how do we reopen the economy, and different disagreements between governors and the federal government, the president, and whatnot. So that's been dominating the news quite a bit with regards to the public health crisis. But today we've got Daniel Cage, who's the CEO and founder of SpeedChain, and Cameron Vanderweel, who is a student at Georgia State. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Daniel, wanted to give you some time to start with introductions and just tell us about yourself, tell us about your career in fintech, and tell us about SpeedChain.
All right. Well, Tommy, thanks for having me. So SpeedChain is a company that's focused on distributed applications through a private blockchain ecosystem. And what we are is a primarily business-to-business digital transformation company. So if you think about blockchain as cryptocurrency, that is not what we do. What we do is really use smart contracts, private blockchain ecosystems, and distributed applications to make communication between companies and agencies easier. And we're focused on payments and security.
Fantastic. And then just tell us a little bit about you and what your career trajectory has been.
Yeah, so I think probably not too different than other entrepreneurs, where I had a series of companies and been real fortunate to, you know, come across incredibly talented people and been able to build some really neat things. I started out years ago in the advertising world, and we were a service company for advertising agencies. And then out of that, had my first payments company, which was really we created a national payments network that allowed state governments to modernize their infrastructure. So one of the things that we kind of what we did most of was actually modernized lotteries in a lot of the states, but really gave us a deep understanding of the regulatory environment of payments, what kind of modern e-commerce technology platforms were available, and have always been kind of really a fan of innovative fintech.
Cameron, tell us about you.
So I'm a sophomore at Georgia State University. I'm pursuing a finance undergraduate degree with a fintech certificate. I first started getting interested in fintech. My dad, he works in payment processing for Enterprise Holdings. So I always grew up hearing him talking about it, and I never really understood it. But now that I'm pursuing a degree in it, a lot of the things he said growing up are starting to make sense. He would always talk about like bits and coins, and they do a lot with credit cards. So how do they store those numbers safely and securely? And how is their front end meeting with their back end? And how are they meeting client expectations?
Oh, that's I love that. And then I love you've gotten involved with the Georgia FinTech Academy. I think your timing's good for being interested in this industry. You know, the FinTech Academy's just a little bit over a year old. And so you're kind of showing up really at a great time when there's more focus being placed by the university system on this this industry.
Yeah. So I first heard about the FinTech Academy when I worked the Robinson College of Business holiday party. I'm a student assistant in the dean's office, and Mr. Manoj Govindan walked up to me and he was like, "Hey, what are you doing here? Like, you look a little young." we got to know each other, and his interest in me started recirculated and came back into the FinTech Academy. So part of it was where I grew up, and part of it was just being in the right place at the right time. So I'm happy to be here and happy to learn more.
That's good. Manoj is one of the greatest salespeople in the history of the FinTech industry. We had him on this podcast just a few episodes ago talking about the new initiative he's been working on, Kashat Ventures. Manoj, he started the technology partnerships group at Bank of America kind of over 10 years ago, and then got involved in doing a similar kind of building a similar organization at Wells Fargo. So he's really got some deep roots into the fintech industry. So that's that's great. I'm thrilled you've gotten a chance to interact with him. I thought, Daniel, particularly since we've got you here as in the depth of your expertise in blockchain technology and the fact you're building a company to support the evolution of that technology, I thought we'd kind of get started kind of diving into blockchain tech a bit and how we've been seeing this develop over the last, almost exactly 11 years now since Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever that is, or whomever that is, dropped Bitcoin. What kind of focused your attention on this technology in regards to the establishment of SpeedChain?
So I think there's a couple elements to the actually underlying technology that attracted not only me, but a number of business owners. It really, I think you can boil it down to, it's really scalability, security, and usefulness for businesses. So if you think about kind of a migration to cloud, was revolutionary for businesses, and how what we all grew up being a technology stack was kind of transferred into different types of technology, and certainly cloud-based has changed the way we all behave in a business setting. I think blockchain, certainly certain types of blockchain or certain elements of the underlying technology will do the same. So if you think about both from, I don't think the end user will know the difference, only that they will be more secure and their providers will be able to scale more quickly and be more efficient. So, that has to do with the underlying decentralization and the hosting, the way you can host data and secure it. And so that really is what, we say internally that it's not technology that we need to be more functional, it's the users need to be functional by using the technology. So if this new technology allows companies to provide products that are more efficient for their users, that cost less, that are more secure, then it is useful. It's valuable. So that's really what excited us and continues to excite us. And I think really there is so much opportunity in different verticals. It's really kind of up to up to us to really pick the most useful and most valuable use cases for it, and really the markets that have the least friction, or I could say it in a different way, where adoption is easier for the end user, and where the most valuable kind of pieces of it for partners are. And I think fintech is certainly one of them. And yeah. I think that you can, there's a lot, you know, obviously there's some big names that are already in it in financial services, but I do think for merchant payments and some other areas that are less kind of traveled so far will become more so over the next, you know, 2 to 3 to 5 years.
Yeah. The in late 2018, Nishant Das, who's the associate professor of finance at the Scheller College of Business at Georgia Tech, he teamed up with me, and we did a very quick study on where blockchain technology was beginning to take hold as a kind of to create some of these meaningful infrastructural opportunities and hypes. And what we immediately were seeing was the cross-industry application. I mean, everything, agriculture, arts and rec, automotive, financial services, of course, healthcare, insurance, manufacturing, mining, property, public sector, retail, tech, media, telecom, transportation, utilities. I mean, these are just almost every segment of the economy. And we found a study that McKinsey had done in the middle of 2018 that was interesting to us. And they were talking, or they measured more qualitatively, like blockchain adoption in all these various industry sectors. And then they were looking at it from where there's a revenue growth potential, where there's a cost save potential, where it could bring meaningful social impacts. And some of the ones that really popped out were, not surprisingly, ones we hear more and more of. I think I certainly do as I'm trying to stay on top of the space. So it's like agriculture. There's this, the example there is the food trust that's been built up by Walmart, and IBM's been very involved in that, and others. Financial services, which we'll talk more about. Healthcare, which we've seen different engagement on resources. Insurance was noted as a big area for potential cost saves. Property, the public sector, those were the handful that really popped in terms of opportunity industries. And it sounds like as you've been taking SpeedChain to market, a handful of those industries are ones that have been resonating.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a long, the list that you just read off is long, but accurate. You know, I think that there's really what you're underscoring is anywhere where interoperability or communication between different organizations or the importance of the chain of custody of data. And as you said, in agriculture and some other things, it's also tied to actual physical assets. So you can talk about kind of the tokenization or digitization of ownership. Those are all things that are kind of underlying benefits of blockchain. So it's not surprising that it would have a wide kind of use appeal.
Mm-hmm. In my consulting business, I think it was in early 2013. We were doing a fair number of like short sprint projects that were more focused on clients. These are all financial services clients that were just trying to understand, okay, what is this tech and how could this be useful to us in terms of either service delivery or how we run our business. And so we were doing those types of projects and then began to get exposed to some different startups, as well as we had some of our technology teams working with Ethereum and Hyperledger in particular. It was pretty interesting because we could see where you could really get some amazing efficiencies and improve security. And there's this smart contract feature that began to, as Ethereum was launched in particular, became an interesting component where, or, you know, as we learn more about it, we would joke because we were like, you know, they're not, smart contracts is a fun word, but they're not really that smart. It's kind of this if then statements that are pretty somewhat simplistic or put in. But we had this really cool project for one of the large global investment banks. They were that has a meaningful securities lending business. And I didn't know a lot about SEC lending until we got into this. But as we were studying it, we realized that's a kind of part of the market that's pretty manual, heavily manual. A lot of Excel spreadsheets, a lot of phone calling. And this there's just some we did a little proof of concept and we could just see there'd be some really remarkable scale improvements and cost saves by using this blockchain technology to just keep track of the loans that were being securitized and into these all these various private placements. And then there are all these different rules that for each provider of the of a different tranche of the loan, they would get different kind of rights given to them based on, you know, whatever they put in, or they could negotiate different rights. So a full SEC lending package can get quite complex as you've got more participants in it. And you could really see the benefits of this, this technology.
Absolutely, yeah.
But Cameron, you were telling me that you'd had a chance to to be part of that Georgia State FinTech conference that was hosted back in early Feb. And I know there was a lot of some good papers that were provided around blockchain. What kind of jumped out at you in that conference?
So it was the second year of the FinTech Research Conference. And on Saturday morning, they had a paper called Corporate Capture of Blockchain Governance. And it focused on proof of work blockchain and profit squeezing. So kind of taking a look at how can blockchain be manipulated and how can participants be hurt or helped by the equipment producers. So the two main goals they were trying to measure were equipment producers owning and operating their own mining pool. That lowers the average fee, but then they also start to take more ownership of the pool, so there's less reward for the miners. And then equipment producers without pool have a stronger incentive to enter the market. But they also, like, how is that profit squeezing as well? That's probably a little bit more into cryptocurrency than Mr. Cage's speed chain. But I would like to hear more about how proof of work and proof of stake and how if those do affect speed chain.
Hey, thanks, Cameron. It's really cool and heartening to hear of, you know, students like you diving so deeply into it. And look, the future of our business is really going to be based on your talent and your ability to go get it. So I know Tommy shares that we both love to see you in this conversation and appreciate all the work and talent you're throwing at it. So because our future is ultimately going to be in your hands. So. You know, it's funny. So you bring up a really cool delineation in the business. And with any new technology, I think there's this kind of, there's this migration of different, and I don't want to overuse the word forks because we use the word forks in a lot of blockchain, but there are forks in the road in strategy and in business. And so proof of work and Tommy and I know some companies in town here that have blockchains that are based on proof of stake, which is a slightly different take on that. You're right. We're actually not really in that side of the business, but I can lend a little bit of thoughts on it. It is very effective for public blockchains and to establish trust in a network. And that's really basically what proof of stake and what proof of work do. You know, over time, the efficiency, both from an energy perspective, but also from a a business model perspective has gotten better. As it's mature, as the business has matured, there's more miners. To your point, there's also a more sophisticated owner now that is saying, well, wait a second, if I own the machines, why am I going to give this percentage to the miner themselves, or the machine, the kind of what I would call out of network miner, I guess. And so that's changed the economics of that business a little bit. I think, and Tommy will get some other people on that are more kind of know this side of the business better than I. I think that once you start dealing in cryptocurrencies in a secondary market, there's just different market pressures that will drive the maturity of that market, right? So if you have mining farms, where are they? I mean, there's some talk now about like, where are they going to be allowed to reside, like physically? Like, do they have to be in the States? Can they not be in certain areas? Because the regulations are different. So those kind of market pressures will come up as well as we go. So certainly you do bring up a delineation between public blockchains and permissioned or private blockchains. They operate very, very differently, and the end consumer is very different. Typically enterprises will prefer a private blockchain that's processing their data, where a cryptocurrency company can rely on a much bigger group of miners or a public chain.
It's just been fascinating to me to see all of these different protocol iterations beginning to come forward. And I think it's a great sign too. I mean, it just shows continues to be meaningful research, meaningful investment. There's lots of business opportunity that's helping to drive that. I think it's very encouraging. It's been frustrating to me, just as having gotten into this, again, as I mentioned, from a consulting's perspective back in 2013, I just thought, almost 8 years ago now, that this was going to be a technology that was going to kind of get engaged more quickly and in the enterprise businesses, I would say. I mean, I thought it was going to be like really better, kind of more wide scale adoption in 2014, 2015, 2016. And it's really not until now, and I mean, your company is a testament to this, that the kind of large corporate enterprises are really beginning to put very important mission critical types of business processes onto this technology in different ways. So it's been, I guess, more of a marathon than a sprint. but it always is. But it's clear, I guess what's encouraging, that it's clear that it's not a technology that's going away, and it's continuing to improve. So it certainly seems like one that's worth continuing to make really meaningful bets on, and build businesses around.
Well, Tommy, it's funny. We always say that people don't like the way things are, but they don't like to change, right? So I think that in solving some problems from a process perspective, so when you're really dealing in enterprise workflow and risk and security, it's very easy to just put those decisions off, and so I think that it's and digital transformation, I think some companies, every company sees it as a must, but depending on the actual use case or the problem that you're solving, it's just a matter of kind of where are you on that priority list.
Yeah. The other thing, like we have in this conversation over the last 20 or 30 minutes done what so often happens. It's so difficult, it seems, to get into a conversation about blockchain technology without getting into some degree of a conversation around cryptocurrency. That always interests me. And then of course there's continues to be a lot of effort into trying to clarify, differences between cryptocurrency and blockchain technology. I guess the way I try to simply keep it straight in my head is to be like, okay, Bitcoin is the first use case executed on blockchain technology. And then there's, of course, other cryptocurrencies that have come forward, but that are additional, you know, execution of a use case on blockchain technology. And then, you know, and then the two, of course, continue to have a sort of a symbiotic relationship, because that makes sense to me. I mean, as these cryptocurrencies become further adopted and engaged with by consumers and enterprises, et cetera, that just, you know, continues to evolve that use case of blockchain technology. I know, like, even in the middle of this, I've been involved in a lot of different conference calls and whatnot, more in the fintech venture capital community just over the last month, as there's several companies, like companies we've got at Georgia Tech and the Advanced Technology Development Center, that are, you know, good entrepreneurs that are thinking, okay, I've got this really early stage company. Is there some way I should pivot in relation to this COVID-19 crisis? And there's a lot of particularly government funds that are looking to deployed against innovative ideas that could help with response to this public health crisis in all sorts of ways. I know there's several ideas that I've heard of that would be supported by blockchain technology in responding to the crisis. I won't be surprised at all if there's some kind of interesting new companies that come out of this in that regard. But Cameron, do you use Facebook?
Not really.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Excuse me?
When I say Facebook, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I use it to keep up with family members, and that's usually about it. I'm not very active in that space. A lot of my friends and I use
that. Only old people like me and Daniel would probably be the ones on Facebook.
So we actually talked about this in our marketing class. I think Facebook just kind of hit this when it hit the market. It was very like that the consumers that were open to Facebook were of older generations than mine. Like, I think I was probably, I think Facebook was 2012, right? I think, so I was 12 at the time.
Wait, hang on. Facebook, I'm just looking this up. I don't know what I was talking about. It was founded in 2004.
Right, but when did it start to blow up?
You were probably about 5.
Okay, so, all right. So that's a little bit past me.
What's your social media platform of choice?
Probably Instagram, just because that's what I grew up into.
Now, who owns Instagram?
Facebook.
Exactly.
But and by the way, I have a 15-year-old daughter, and she's same thing. Instagram is. So they're doing a good job at a. Well, at a wide age.
One reason I'm bringing up Facebook is, you know, a year ago, they announced their intentions to create this global digital currency that they called Libra. And regulators across the world basically freaked out and were just like, no, you're not doing this, and you're going to have to, you know, really work through all our different regulatory bodies. But I'm only leaping back to that because just today, Libra made a big announcement, or Facebook Libra made a big announcement that they formally commenced the process of obtaining a payment system license in Switzerland. And they said they're expecting and will be asking for input from other central banks and regulatory bodies around the world, not just from the Swiss. So it's almost like they're coming out of we just haven't heard a lot about, you know, how they were going to work on repositioning related to Libra, and were they going to engage in with regulators. So it'll be interesting to see how this new news is received And for us to understand, I'm sure they've had to reposition the Libra currency. I think they're thinking about doing it more as supporting specific stable coins that I think would be tied to particular nation states. But I'm speculating. I mean, we'll have to get into the news or the announcements over the next day. But I guess one last question I wanted to have, well, ask you, Cameron, is like when, like, how do you personally engage with financial services technology, fintech?
I'd say the biggest one as far as like payment processing would be Venmo. Like, that's how most of my friends and I split checks and share money. Some of us also use Zelle. That one's starting to come up because it is integrated into your bank account. As far as cryptocurrency, I haven't really touched the stuff, partially because some of them can get pretty pricey, but also it, for me, it's too new for want to accept that risk. Like, as a younger person, I probably could take on that risk, but then it becomes the talk about it. It is a high cost to enter that market. And for a social media platform to have their own cryptocurrency is an interesting idea. I know personally, I'd probably want to keep, I like to keep my spaces separate. So I probably wouldn't entangle my finances with a social media platform.
The Zelle comment reminded me. So last week, I was invited to get involved with Glenbrook Partners. They put together they're a great payment boutique consulting firm, but they also do training around payments. And they put together a new virtual training that they invited me to be part of last week, which was really good. And we're gonna explore maybe having a relationship between them and the FinTech Academy. But they had really good data on Zelle, and they said that in 2019, Zelle had $187 billion in processing volume. There's now 766 member banks that are signed on to the Zelle network. The $252 is the average transaction amount. You know, it's really been significant. And they had some data too, where they were showing that Zelle adoption has surpassed Venmo, which, you know, I found particularly interesting. That's been a recent development, like in the last 12 months. So it just kind of, it shows once again, the power of, these large banks to, control their destiny in this fintech space.
Yeah. I know personally that the backing of lots of banks has been a big draw for me to start moving more into Zelle and to encourage my friends and family to move over to Zelle. Venmo just is pretty easy to use when it came out. So I know that was a big initial draw for a lot of my friends and I.
Yeah. Yeah. I just found the data I was looking for. The Q4 2019, the transaction volume was about 25 billion ish for Venmo, but Zelle's transaction volume was like 55 billion. So it really has overtaken Venmo in a significant way. And then what's also interesting is that it's in terms of P2P usage, it's kind of dead even with Venmo. There's clearly the folks using Zelle are moving larger sums on Zelle than on Venmo, which is why you see that transaction volume being so much significantly higher. So yeah, but it's just this whole P2P area is really interesting to me. Because I'm still not convinced anybody's making profit on it. They're making revenue, but I'm not convinced they're making profit on that part of the business, and we'll see how that might change as folks like yourself continue to use these platforms and use them for ever increasing sums of money. Let's just before we kind of pivot towards the final part of our conversation. Well, I wanted to just hit on kind of any big fintech news we've heard in the past week. Daniel, what's caught your attention?
You know, I think more than anything is just business continuity. I mean, you know, I think everyone, for rightly so, you know, has, now that we're working at home, and anytime that there's this is unprecedented kind of a common challenge, you know, so everybody across every strata, regardless of where in the world you live, and what you do every day, everyone's affected by something, by this one thing, which is very, very unique. But I think what it's underscored, and I think you mentioned it earlier today in our conversation, is whatever transformation was going to happen is just, it will accelerate. And that's really kind of what we're hearing as well. And I think what we're hearing, it's more around business continuity, right? So we know that you're going to have employees either working remotely or working in a different way. And I think the more that we can trust data and our communication with each other, the better. And that includes, fintech's right in the middle of that. And so I think more than anything, it's that. I think it's security, it's the transformation, and it's really just kind of digitizing our communication as we are doing right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cameron, how about you?
I thought the PayPal, Intuit, and Square getting approved to help with the Small Business Relief Fund was pretty interesting. Whether that is a move to encourage the small businesses they lend to continue to do business with them, or to just take a stake in being responsible and giving back to communities. I thought that was pretty impressive. And as someone who is looking to be employed in the future, that means a lot to me as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know there was, right as the CARES Act got passed in the law, there was a lot of, lobbying that was taking place on behalf of the fintech industry to determine how to, you know, basically get fintechs engaged. And, it made all the sense in the world to me that these kind of, where I think of more mature fintechs like PayPal, Square would really, you know, find a good argument to get engaged and provide a ton of value in helping that payroll protection program.
Tommy, there's also just a credit to a local company who's doing great, is Cabbage was part of that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they have, you know, outreach to small businesses, and I know that they were right in the middle of that. And so that's another example of a younger, smaller company that's not so small anymore, but they've done some good stuff as well.
That's right. The other two bits of news that I found significant in the past week, one, SoFi announced a $1.2 billion acquisition of Galileo Financial Technologies, which is a payment prepaid card processor, just indicating SoFi moving further into the payment space. And then Marcus Pay was launched, which is, Marcus again is the consumer financial services arm of Goldman Sachs. And they launched a point of sale installment lending business, with their first major rollout customer being JetBlue. So there is a very large POS installment lending business born here in Atlanta called Green Sky Financial. So it's I think just continued validation that this point of sale installment lending space is here to stay and is going to continue to grow. Well, good. I'm going to wrap up there. Cameron, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Daniel, thanks for being engaged with the Georgia FinTech Academy in such a significant way. We're here to hopefully participate or support the growth of SpeedChain as that continues to happen.
Tommy, thanks for having me, and love what you and the Academy are doing. It's great.
The Georgia FinTech Academy podcasts are available on iTunes and Spotify. To obtain additional information about the Georgia FinTech Academy, please visit our website at georgiafintechacademy.org.